Hey, it's Greg Gutfeld, also known as The One, 20% of the five, but essentially The One. I'm here with another one, a guy who often sits in for me, Tom Shalhoub.
Yeah.
Tom Shalhoub is on this podcast because I've been reading his new book, Mean Dads for a Better America. This isn't like a plug podcast. This is actually a deep conversation about growing up in a family in a certain era in which a guy from Boston and a guy from San Mateo can have exactly the same upbringings is beyond me. I want to get started because there's so many things that are universal. And I, if you're listening, this is not a plug for a book. This is actually interesting stuff. But this – when you were talking about Little League, and I wondered how many kids went through what you did and what I did, which is what – we didn't want the first thing we wanted to do was not play sports.
Yes. But you had to.
Yes. And you, but so you got – so actually you were more nervous for me on a Saturday having to put on this Little League thing than actually going to school because my – you know, I didn't want to disappoint my parents.
Yeah. I mean, it was like Friday, school's out. And
yes.
It's like you're – but then the next day, it's like, yeah, it's a worse trial.
Yes.
You know, having to stand at home plate.
And you were in right field.
Oh, yeah.
So like, was I.
Yeah, right field.
Right field. And when the, and they put you there because no one hits there.
Yeah.
But once in a while, once – and the ball will come at you, I would catch it and always drop it.
Yeah, and then – but I had a pretty good arm. I could get it in.
Yes.
I could get it into to home plate.
This is what Tom Shalhoub is. Tom Shalhoub is always sees the bright side. You were a terrible athlete, but you had a good arm. I was undisciplined, but I was fast. I could steal bases.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I could steal bases. But, like, don't expect me to, like, do anything that requires some kind of finesse. Yeah. Also, I could be violent. Like when I was not a good soccer player.
Yeah, but you could.
But I could slide tackle the hell out of somebody.
Uh-huh, yeah.
By the way, before I go any further, I want to point out on a certain page, I was very shocked. Do you know what's on page 223?
What? A mistake.
No.
Oh.
You swore.
Oh, yes. 223. Read it out. Can you? You can.
Yeah, you could bleep it. Bleep it. We would. This is about when this. You were swearing when you're talking about doing your quartet, your barbershop quartet.
Yeah, to me,
are you describing how you sing a song? We would tear the shit out of "You Must Have Been a Beautiful Baby." You were talking about a song.
Yeah,
I it was just like that, I would go, "Oh, Tom swore. This is not a family book."
All of a sudden, it's funny because I was really wondering about that swear, but to me, it was funny in the context of that.
Yeah, of course,
because it's like, when is the one time I swear? When I'm saying I'm going to tear the blank
out of a song.
Have been a beautiful baby.
Yeah, and also you're swearing. It's like you're taking Barbershop Quartet, which you have a really great chapter on, and you're talking about it as though it's like rap music.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, what, you know, I'm going to rip this apart.
Yeah. Because we thought we were the tough guys. We were tougher than the musical theater kids.
Well, yeah. When you put it in that context,
yeah.
Yes, you were. But in the context of life – you would not have survived. I also like in your Little League, when you're talking about the fact that lopsided games are like you're either – there was never like 5-4. It was 21-3. And you were either the 21 or the 3 because there was – it all had to do with maturation?
Yeah.
Maturity. That – it was a huge difference between like a 7-year-old and an 8-year-old.
Well, and yeah, it was the – The half a year,
yes.
6 months in the development of a boy
right.
is huge. And so we would be – I can remember the pitchers' names.
Yes.
Brian Baldwin, he mm-hmm. was unhittable. Stu Babbs, unhittable. I'll never forget these guys because they could fire fastballs over the plate.
Yes.
So it renders the other team useless.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was actually talking about Brian Baldwin and then his brother – I think I mentioned him on a podcast or something. I just happened to say his name, that he was unhittable. And his brother sent me a message through Facebook, and he was like, yeah, he actually went to minor league. He had a good career.
This is what I like about the book is there's a lot of universal stuff in here. Every time I read it, I have to – like, there's certain things that I haven't thought about in years, like driving safety films that we were forced to watch.
Yeah.
You talk about that. And also you talk about, like, chapels and classrooms – and there was always this thing that you did and I did, which was to sneak into a place afterwards that somehow made like a place really spooky.
It's unbelievable.
Like, yeah, we would go by my grade school and sneak in through into a window and then like run around the classroom. It was just a room.
But it was so fun to be in there.
Yeah.
In the church. I mean, are you talking about me and
– you used to have races in the chapel.
Yeah. And yeah. you know, going in there in the dark, and you're in the church.
Yes.
And you have your run of the place.
Yes.
It's amazing.
It is. I like that you mentioned Dwight Stones. I haven't thought about him in ages. That is like I haven't heard the name Dwight Stones.
He was the first alternative guy that I knew. Like he was a high jumper, and he wore a Mickey Mouse shirt.
Yes.
And it was like, well, that's a guy who's comfortable in his masculinity.
That was your first inspiration as a cool guy. Yeah. Was Dwight Stones with his T-shirt, and like he was a different Olympic athlete. There was an interesting thing too where you talk about being an altar boy, and like I was an altar boy. I can describe my entire life with the ringing of the bells. You talk about ringing of the bells and how altar boys approached it in different ways. The ringing of the bells to me describes my entire life, and that before I do something, I am so filled with anguish. It was started with the bells, but any time –
Catholics know the bells. They know what we're talking about.
Yeah, you ring the bells. That is – all I have to do is ring the bells, but I'd be filled with so much fear that I would get it wrong. That's the same thing when I've done everything from sports to television, writing. I have to just get over that ringing of the bells in the beginning. Is that weird?
Yes, and it's the whole thing depends on you. The priest stops the mass, and you have to ring the bells.
Yes.
I think it's do this in memory of me. That's the cue for everything.
Do this in memory of me. And I like how you try to do it as long as possible to drive the priest crazy. You also – there's some interesting things about discovering things for the first time in this book that like you have to remind yourself – what it was like before you heard rock music. So you liked for me, it was always novelty music. Like I liked Ray Stevens because I never knew what rock music was. And then rock music comes along. In your case, it was Meat Loaf.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden it's like, ooh, what is this?
It seems so dangerous.
Yes, yes.
I can remember watching them on Saturday Night Live because that was – you'd stay up late and you'd watch SNL and then you would – if you were really daring, you'd stay for Don Kirshner's rock concert.
Oh, which I did all the time because I was a punker. You and I map almost – you're a couple years younger than me, but we almost map identically on new wave music and how I dressed in high school was I would go to San Francisco to Union Street and buy parachute pants.
Yeah.
And I would save up my money and I'd buy these new wave pants and a sleeveless like kind of like mock leather shirt, wraparound sunglasses, and that's what I would wear when I'd go see the B-52s or the Cramps or whatever. And it's like you have a whole chapter of you and I dressed probably at the same time in the 80s, exactly the same.
Yeah, it was that you threw together whatever you could.
I think you probably had more style than me, but I was more into it, I think. I was a punk.
But did you get grief for wearing those outfits to school? Because I was, you know, that's why I say punk in there. And my editor said, we got to change this. That's not punk. And I'm like, no, it was punk.
It was punk.
Because she's younger than us. She doesn't realize that the Police were called punk.
Yeah, the first album was looked like punks.
Yeah.
And New Wave didn't become New Wave until people started looking backwards and saying there was some kind of – it was the addition of the synthesizer, the Gary Numan Cars element that you bring up. That was a shift from the Marshall beat of The Clash and Gang of Four. And then Gang of Four almost then went from punk to New Wave when they added kind of like an airier sound. You also – before I forget, my favorite Universal is Hedge Porn. When you were growing up as kids, what did every neighborhood? What could you find in a park or in a tree?
Playboys.
Yes.
And you had to know. The thing was, it was like the trees. We had Shattuck Park, which was near my home, and teenagers would hang out there. And you know, it was funny because Nick Gillespie as well. I was talking to him the other day, and he was like, "Teenagers was synonymous with juvenile delinquent. It meant just don't go near teenagers.
Yeah, they were bad things, bad creatures.
Because they would drink, you know, and then you'd see a group of teenagers in the woods, and then they would leave, and you'd be like, okay, we can go in the woods now. And you'd go in there, and there'd be beer cans in a circle, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But then you would look nearby, and there would be a hollowed-out tree.
Yes.
And you just it was like you'd reach inside, and there was guaranteed to be a rolled-up magazine in there.
Yeah, you know what's funny? I called the police on a teenager because he scared me on the way to school. And it turned into such a big deal. I think he was just messing with me. John Jerome. Isn't that amazing that I remember this name?
Exactly.
Third grade, I'm walking, and he's in Hidden Park, which is next to my house.
It's called Hidden Park?
They were called Hidden Parks, and there were two of them in San Mateo. And I was walking, and he said, "Hey, Greg." And he knew my sister, who I guess my sister was already in high school, so maybe I was in like fourth grade. He was a friend of Jeannie's. and he was holding a little vial. He goes, you know what this is? This is marijuana. And I'm like, do you want some? And it's like 8 in the morning.
Yeah.
And he's just screwing with me.
How old are you?
I guess, okay, Jeannie is 6 years older than me, so she might have been a freshman in high school. I'd say fourth grade.
Yeah. And fourth grade?
Yeah. And I'm like, And he's like, he goes, yeah. And I go, and so I run to school, which it seems like forever, but it's probably like 4 blocks.
Yeah, yeah.
To St. Gregory's, and I tell the teacher, and it becomes one of those teachable moments. Okay, class, we have a story to tell. And then they had a police officer come. And
you told the teacher about marijuana.
Yeah, and the kid, I told on the kid. I don't know what happened to him. Turns out he was probably just kidding.
Yeah.
But he never –
he might have had a bag of leaves or something,
yeah, he
right?
never hung around with my sister again. But that's the way I liked it. You know, it's so funny. You also talk about kids with single parents and how they kind of know things.
Yeah.
That's where, like, I first tried drugs was with a kid who's had divorced parents because, like, he knew what drugs were, and he saw – and like there were barriers that were gone.
Yeah.
There were barriers that were missing.
They couldn't – you know, because they always had – it was usually like an older brother or, you know, somebody. And they had the freedom because whatever it was with this – my friend with the single mom, she was out, you know, working. And then the kids were free, you know, in the home to do all sorts of things.
And they always had this belief like, well, if you're going to do it, at least do it while I'm home. So the first time I ever got high was at this guy Bob's house with his mother in the kitchen. That's just not – it's not normal, but that's what happens. It's so funny. You have the same – things that I – like you mentioned, stuff like the $6 million man. What's interesting about coming to Fox is that now I'm friends with Lee Majors.
Yeah.
So I – you know, I've had drinks with Lee Majors. He's done my show. And it's like if I knew that in 1975, I don't think I would sleep until now.
Yeah.
I would just stay up and wait.
Yeah. That would be anticipation.
Yes.
But the bionics –
Bionics! Did you want to be bionic?
I mean, I thought I would be bionic.
And so did I!
And so when I went into the doctors, I would think, is this the one? They're going to make me bionic. Like,
yeah.
I really thought it was... Because there was no... The thing is, people don't understand pre-Star Wars. You had to get your... You had to get into something.
Yes.
And so, you know, I watched Batman as a kid, and... Mm-hmm. But then when Lee Majors came along, he kicked it up to such a high level.
Yeah.
You know, when he was on you know, at the beginning, you know, we can rebuild him. It was just the mythology of it and the idea that he was half man, half machine.
Did you ever think, because you heard these stories all the time, we were always told, read a story, did you hear about the boy that lifted up a car and freed his dad because a car fell on him? That, like, you could access strength? Like, you knew that if it happened, you could turn over a car?
Yeah.
That was always in my head.
Yeah, there was always, the kid,
the kid
who freed his mother.
Tree.
Yeah.
And it was like, it never happened. It probably never happened.
And if it did happen, it was like... You know, I pictured it when you would hear that story. You would picture this little kid with the whole car over his head.
Exactly.
You know, completely pressing it.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's not. That's not how it was.
But then Lee Majors, right?
Yeah.
He's the ultimate man. He's the $6 million man.
Yeah.
And then he married that poster.
Farrah Fawcett.
Like,
he married our poster. Yes. That is so true. That is so true. He was like you could have a male crush growing up because you didn't understand it as a kid. Like why this person is like the greatest person ever. It was like almost, because you didn't go through, you know, you didn't have puberty or you didn't know, but then you found girls and that kind of stuff went away.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. But we didn't know there was, I mean, back in the 6 million days, it was definitely, it was just, you know, it was. You knew he had this beautiful woman as a wife, and that was all you needed to know. You know, there wasn't anything more than that. I was in, you know, I thought he should have gotten together with the bionic woman. I thought Lindsay.
They're doing a movie together, did you know, for a lifetime.
Really?
I asked him what it's about. He goes, it's just one of those romantic things women like. That's what he said to me. He goes, I got to go to Vancouver or something and film this with Lindsay Wagner. I go, wow, Lindsay Wagner. I go, I'm talking to Lee Majors about the bionic woman. I'm like a friend of his now.
Yeah.
So what's how's she doing? Oh, she's all right. Yeah, we're just doing some stuff together.
It's mind-boggling. And Kurt Russell. Kurt Russell was in all our movies because it was
from
the strongest man in the world.
From the beginning.
Yeah.
And he was like the coolest. He never aged. By the way, I love the story about the semi-formal because I went through this. When a girl – you like a girl.
Yeah.
But another girl likes you. And the girl that likes you, you don't see why what potential is there. So you're kind of a jerk. I remember – I still feel guilty about a girl named Beth who asked me to the prom. But I was waiting for another girl.
Yeah.
And and I got and the other girl didn't go with me, so I went with Beth, and I was a total jerk.
Yes, and it's like passive aggressive. You really take it out on them.
Yeah, and then I went to Berkeley, and I came back to a party. You know, come back from college in a fraternity.
Yeah.
go to a party, and she's there, and I'm acting really cool and stupid and doing shots, and she's like, "You know what, Greg, you're an," and I was like, "She was right." She was so right.
The girl you went to the prom with.
Yeah, she just said it. She was like, she was saying it in the way of, I saw potential in you as being a good kid.
Yeah.
You were a good, funny, wholesome kid, but look at you now. You're just like all the rest. You're a drunk, stupid jerk. And I thought that's how I thought about it. It was like, I thought it was very moving to me. I love the story about you doing the gong show in high school. And the jokes, I won't ruin it for everybody, but it's such a good story. But again, our lives, for our big event at school, I hosted the dating game.
You did?
Yeah, I wore outrageous tuxedo. It was me, a guy named Brian, who was it? Was it Brian Sailors? And we sang, I wrote the song to the tune of The Love Boat, called it The Dating Game.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the Bill Murray thing. And I rhymed open shores with open sores.
But wait a minute. That's very dirty, Greg.
Yes, it was.
But The Dating Game is like, that was kind of a risque show. This was high school?
Yeah, this was high school. And the guy who played the keyboards, here's an interesting fact, was a guy named Kevin Gilbert. Kevin Gilbert, who died mysteriously.
Wow.
Google him.
Oh, because it's like a conspiracy.
It's really an interesting story.
Wow,
he used
Kevin
to date
Gilbert.
Sheryl Crow.
Holy,
and,
moly.
It's like an unusual. Let me just say unusual story. We'll be right back with Tom Jaloux. No, we won't, because there's no commercials in a podcast. Actually, I'd like to sell you a reverse mortgage and a catheter. It's both a reverse mortgage and a catheter in one, and it can fit in your pocket. A reverse mortgage that can fit in your pocket. There you go. Sorry. I love the chapter on you getting into barbershop quartet and how you end up kind of turning it into something really successful that nobody does. You found your like unusual niche.
Well, I actually did think that we were so cool, cuz it's cool. Like barbershop sounds, you can't get around it. Forget about the irony, like, "Oh, look, they are dressed up in those suits,"
yes.
You know. And people kind of think like, oh, you know, like the ragtime gals, they're like, "Oh, man, there's something about that. You guys are really funny." It's like, yeah, you know what's good about it? It's good.
Yeah. Well, it's hard to do.
Yeah.
And it takes practice. And I love how you say that. It's like, the great thing about barbershop quartet is you can take it anywhere.
Yeah, you can. And you can be the star of any party or, you know, sing in the street. But I thought that it would be my key into show business, because I thought I succeeded in the high school show. And then you think you're like, wait a minute, I'm pretty good because I made an auditorium of people laugh. And it's not that hard to do because it's all your classmates, you know. So you have an outsized, you know, idea of yourself. But I thought that the quartet was like, wow, maybe this could be my ticket into show business. So I sent videotapes of the quartet to Lorne Michaels.
That's amazing.
Requesting to be the musical guest on Saturday Night Live.
That's like, that is, you know, that is either brave or psychopathic. Because you think that it's possible.
Yeah.
That I would never do that. But see, you're very different. You put yourself out there. I don't put myself out anywhere.
It is psychopathic, though.
Yeah, no, I think you – but remember when you were first on Red Eye, I always joked that you were a serial killer
yes.
In your intros, and I always talk about the fact that you had bodies in your trunk because no one could be as happy-go-lucky without being a psychopath as you. Like, everything's okay. Everything's going to be great, blah, blah, blah. And I go, oh, he's got to have, like, bodies in the basement. And I'm still not sure. You know, you bring up so many interesting things in the book. I love the fact that you talk about wine coolers. I haven't thought of a wine cooler in ages. Probably the weirdest drink ever.
Just horrible.
Horrible.
Horrible. And sweet but designed for – I mean, so designed for underage people to drink. There's no reason, because there's no one over 21 ever drank them.
It's you know what it should have been called? How to get a teenage girl drunk alcohol.
Yes.
Because, like, the whole point of – like, God, this is an interesting point. Like, alcohol tastes bad. Let's admit it.
Yeah.
Right? There's nothing – like, things that taste good are things that are supposed to taste good. I like cake, Coca-Cola. These things sweet, but alcohol tastes. Don't kid yourself that when you first took your taste of beer, you said this tastes good. Yeah. No, it tastes like shit. But over time, you train yourself to say, I like fine wine. Oh, this whiskey burns. I like the way. Oh, nice whiskey. No, all of it tastes bad. It's all bad tasting, and it forces you to accommodate it, right? Yeah.
Yes. Now don't you are drawn to it. So is it because you just have gotten used to it and you've surrendered to the taste, or you get older and you like, you know, more horrible things?
I think here's the thing. I don't like sweet things that change my mentality, like a sweet drink.
Yeah,
like
I don't want it.
Imagine if Coca-Cola had the same power as whiskey. I don't think I could drink it.
No. That's why I can't stand rum and cokes. I don't understand.
Exactly.
It's like, I want the alcohol. I don't eat drink mixed drinks. I want the 100% alcohol.
Right.
Or 100%, you know, if I want to drink a cranberry juice, I will. It's rare.
Yes. Isn't that strange? And it's like, I guess it's because we've just been trained to be that way, I guess.
Well, I can remember my friends using techniques. My friend saying to me, if you look at the moon, because, you know, you have to like drink a couple of beers, like that's the requirement. So you're standing there in the woods, and my friend was like, if you look at the moon and just stare at the moon and think about the moon, you can drink really fast, you know. So it was like, don't think about it, concentrate on something else.
You know what's hilarious is that was such a big deal about, you know, Steve, you can drink really fast.
Yeah.
He's a fast. And it was like, yeah, I can pound a beer. It was like, that was like a real achievement. And who knew that was actually, no, you're not supposed to teach you don't want to be the fast drinker because your life will be over.
Yeah. If they could go in time and see what happened that guy who could shoot beers, or even the six, like drinking a six. Cause like the big guys on the football team, they'd be like, get me a six. And then you were supposed to say, get me a six if you were a guy.
Yeah. It was like, and you're bragging about it the next day. It's like, yeah, I drank a six, or I had eight. How many did you drink? I had eight beers.
Yeah,
it's the testosterone wanting to belong weirdness, and it was like an achievement.
Yeah. So I used to say, find a girl, I'll split a six with her. Like it was, I would make fun of myself. I'd be like, no, I don't want a six. Find me a girl and I'll split it with her. Like a girl, because it was like I was admitting that I wasn't man enough to drink a six. And so that kind of took the edge off. And they were like, ah, Shaloo, he's horsing around. Get him. Hey, he's about to split a six with a girl.
Yes.
I didn't mention this in the book. I used to dress up like an old man to buy alcohol.
No.
Yes.
That's amazing.
Yeah, but it just... It didn't seem to match with the, you know, I couldn't find anywhere to put it, but because everyone used to try to grow beards and look older.
Yes, of course.
I was like, wait a minute, why add like a few years? Why not add like
so many years?
60 years. So I would put powder in my hair, and I had this old coat, and I would walk in as an old man, and they would carry the case of beer out to my car for me.
That is so simple. And how did I'm sitting there trying to like buy a fake ID, and when all I had to do was put like
go all the way.
Yes.
And they don't ask an old man for his ID. It's just too ridiculous a thing to do.
I think that if any children are listening to this podcast, they have just you have just made their lives.
I don't recommend it, but what you need is an overcoat,
and you don't
a pair
much.
Of glasses, a pair of glasses, because the glasses fog up your eyes so they can't see the young eyes.
Yes.
And then I would, and this was in the days when they, you know, you could smoke in and out of places. Yeah. I would bring a cigarette, and then the smoke would obscure. So you'd walk in with it. So, and then I had a fedora hat, and then I would put powder just in the sides,
Jesus.
Baby powder.
That is amazing. That is so brilliant. Why didn't I think of that? I never thought of that because I was too – I think I'd been too scared. There's a lot of great stuff in this book. You talk about so many things that are part of my life, and I realize that aren't in any movies. Like when I think about the two coming-of-age films that I really like, which are Dazed and Confused, that was a few years before us.
But that one is very – he's solid. Like he touches on real things.
And his follow-up, which Everybody Wants Some, is fantastic.
Yeah.
It's those – kind of kids now going to college. It's just like the next – they go away to college.
Yeah.
But they're still about 2 years to 3 years before us. Like it seems like they're going to college in 1980 when we're going to high school.
Yeah. Yeah.
And those two movies are two of my favorites. But there's no movie that really gets this weird, bizarre time. But maybe we're just old people.
Yeah.
I think we are.
I mean, it's a very specific – I think like people got they got the 80s right in many ways. They got the 50s and 60s right. But I always contend no one got the 70s right. So that's what I set out to do with the book.
Yeah.
And then I kind of it turned into the dad's thing. Like, I wanted to write a memoir of the 70s, but then there was so much mom and dad stuff that became the dominant theme. But, like, I think the first part of the book, to me, is it was me trying to get small-town America in the 70s right for once.
Which you did. And we have to wrap up, but I do feel like it's a history book. And I underlined so many things, and my sister said thank you for the because the book arrived yesterday. I think because her and her husband grew up in the 70s. It'll do that. But so you listeners, it's Mean Dads for a Better America. It's Tom Shalhoub's book. I was actually at a publishing company today, and they were like marveling over the cover.
Really?
They really like the cover. That's something you don't really, you know, it's a really good cover. It's great, actually.
Do judge a book by its cover.
Yeah. Actually, I think it's an important thing to do. I judge everything by its cover.
Yeah.
That's why you should always have a clean cover. Like, I would never get into a bed with a dirty cover. I've done that.
Oh.
You know, like, judge a bed by its cover.
Yes.
If people having sex on that cover, that means they're just sloppy people.
I mean,
I don't even know if that's a good thing. Tom, should I stop talking now?
Look, these always go so quick, our talks, Greg.
That's because we're essentially talking to each other and no one else.
Yeah.
Do you want to go away together?
I mean, wouldn't it be great? Just.
You know, I have a small boat. We could be in Cuba in an hour.
Where do you go? Do you go to islands? Are you a paradise type of person? Or?
I may like to sit in my apartment and do nothing.
Yeah.
And it drives my wife crazy because I think too much about travel to enjoy it. And then when I get there, I think about going home. And it's really not healthy. And I don't think it's ever going to change or get better. I think it's just going to get worse. I'm going to Italy in 6 weeks or so to see Elena because she's in an internship.
Yep.
And I'm already like anguishing over having to fly international.
Yeah.
It's the way I'm the opposite of you, Tom.
Yeah.
You live in the Bronx. I mean, I couldn't do that. I don't even know I don't even know where the Bronx is.
It's just north of the city.
I know, but the name scares me because of the movie Fort Apache, the Bronx. All right. It's now, we talked for 30 minutes.
Fantastic.
Thanks, Tommy.
We'll see. Oh, we should say the show, right?
What show?
My show, the Tom Shalhoub Show.
Oh.
The radio show.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Might as well announce it. Yes. I haven't announced it anywhere yet, though, might as well do it on your podcast, right?
Yeah.
The Tom Shalhoub Show, Fox News Radio, 3 to 6 every day.
Excellent. There you go. Congrats. Thanks, guys. Bye-bye.